Cassette 3, Side 2.
Chapter 16. Galactics. Rejoice, crooned the fourth brother of the ebony shadows. Rejoice that the fifth moon of the small dusty planet has been conquered. The brothers of the night had fought bitterly for this fulcrum of power, from which they would soon project irresistible might to sweep the skies of heretics and blasphemers. This moon would guarantee that the prize would be theirs, and theirs alone. None of the other moons in the Kestemony system had the one attribute this one possessed, a core of almost 1% unobtainium. Already 30 of the brothers' ships had landed to begin construction of the weapon. The library, as always, had been the key. Many cycles ago, the fourth brother of the Ebony Shadows had come across an obscure reference to a device once used in a war between two races now long extinct. It had taken half his lifespan to hunt down the details, for the library was a labyrinth. But now would come his payment. Rejoice, the cry resounded. It was a paean of triumph meant to be heard, and, indeed, a few other combatants began to notice that something curious was going on over in the corner of Kestemony's system. While the fiercest battles raged around the strategic gas giant world and Kithrop itself, some enemies had begun sending scouts this way to see what the Brothers of the Night were up to. Let them come and look. Can it matter? A ship of the Sorrow had been watching them for some time. Could it have divined their purpose? Never. The citation was too obscure. Our new weapon has sat unnoticed too long in the dusty archives. They will first understand when this moon begins to vibrate on the 15th probability band, sending out waves of uncertainty that will tear their battle fleets apart. Then their shipboard libraries will undoubtedly remember, but too late. The brother of the Ebony Shadows watched from space as the resonator neared completion, watched as grounded ships fed their combined energies to the resonator. From 1,000 units out, he could feel the wave build. What are they doing? What are the progenitor scorned Sorrow doing? Instruments showed that the Brothers of the Night were not alone on the 15th band. From the Sorrow ship came a small tone, a variation of the beat emanating from the small moon, an echo. The 15th band began to throb. Impossibly, it resonated along with the Sorrow rhythm. The brothers on the ground tried to damp the runaway signal, but it was already too late. The small moon shook and finally crumbled. Great shards of rock tumbled apart, crushing the little ships in their way. How could they have known? How could they? Then the brother of the Ebony Shadows understood. Long ago, when he had begun his search for a new weapon, there had been a helpful librarian, a Pelan. The Pelan had always been there with the useful suggestion, with the helpful reference. The brother had thought nothing of it. Librarians were supposed to be helpful and neutral, whatever their backgrounds. But the pill are clients to the Sorrow. The brother realized. Krat knew all along. He gave the order, sending his remaining forces into hiding. This is only a setback. We shall yet be the ones to capture the Earthlings. Behind the fleeing remnants, the small moon continued to dissolve. Chapter 17. Tom Orley. Hannes Suessi lay prone on a heavy work sled next to Thomas Orley. The gaunt, balding artificer gestured at the wreck before them.
It's a Thenanan ship, the chief engineer said. It's pretty badly crumpled, but there's no doubt. See? No objectivity anchors, only stasis projectors on the main flanges. The Thenanen are terrified of reality alteration. This ship was never designed to use a probability drive. Definitely Thenanen, or a Thenanen client or ally.
The dolphins circled slowly nearby, taking turns at the air domes underneath the sled, emitting excited sonar clicks as they eyed the gigantic crushed arrowhead below them.
"I think you're right, Hannes," Tom said. "It's a behemoth."
That the ship was still in one piece was amazing. In its Mach 5 meeting with the ocean, it had caromed off at least two subsurface islands, leaving substantial dents in them, and plowed a deep gouge in the ocean floor before finally catching up against a furrow of pelagic mud just before it would have smashed into a sheer scarp. The cliff face looked crumbly and precarious. Another substantial jolt would surely cause a collapse, burying the wreck completely. Orly knew it was the quality of the Thenanen stasis shields that made such a performance possible. Even in dying, a Thenanen ship was reputed to be not worth putting out of its misery. In battle, they were slow, unmaneuverable, and as hard to disable permanently as a cockroach. It was difficult to assess the damage. Down here, the illumination from the surface was blue-tinged and dim. The Fen wouldn't turn on the arc lights they had strung up until Tish said it was safe. Fortunately, the wreck was in water shallow enough to visit, yet deep enough to shield them from spy eyes overhead. A pink-bellied bottlenose dolphin swam up next to the sled. She worked her food mouth in a thoughtful, circular motion.
"It's really amazing, isn't it, Tom?" she asked. "It should be in a jillion pieces."
This deep, there was an odd clarity to the Finn's voice. Bursts of air from her blowmouth and sonar clicks joined in a complex manner to make speech an intricate juggling of bodily functions. To a landlubber human, a neo-dolphin speaking underwater sounded more like an avant-garde orchestra tuning up than someone speaking a derivative of the English language.
"Do you think we can make any use of it?" the dolphin officer asked.
Orly looked again at the ship. There was a good chance that in the confusion of battle, none of those contending over Kithrop had bothered to note where this sparrow had fallen. He already had a few tentative ideas, one or two of which might be bold, unexpected, and idiotic enough to work.
"Let's give it a look," he nodded. "I suggest we split into three groups. Team one heads for any center of emissions, particularly probability, psi, or neutrino radiation, and disables the source. They should also watch out for survivors, though that seems unlikely."
Suessi snorted as he looked at the pounded wreck. Orly went on. "Team two concentrates on harvesting. Hannes should lead that one, along with Titscha. They'll look for monopoles and refined metals Streaker can use. Well, with luck, they might find some replacements for those coils we need. With your permission, Tish, I'll take team three. I want to look over the structural integrity of that ship and survey the topography of the surrounding area." Tish performed a jaw clap of agreement.
"Your logic is good, Tom. That is what we'll do. I'll leave Lucky Ka with the other sled on alert. The rest shall join their teams at once."
Orly grabbed Tisht's dorsal fin as she was about to whistle the command.
"Oh, we'd better go with breathers all around, hadn't we? Trinary may not be efficient, but I'd rather put off complex conversations in Anglic than have to risk everybody shuttling back and forth for air, and maybe someone getting hurt."
Tisht grimaced, but gave the command. The party was composed of disciplined Fen, the pick of Streaker's crew, so the gathering at the sled was occasion merely for low-pitched grousing and indignant bubbles, as each dolphin was fitted with a wraparound hose of air. Tom had heard of prototype breathers that would give a fin a streamlined air supply without hindering the speech mouth. If ever he found the time, he might try to rig some up himself.